Geez, yeah, I guess you would be a major. What was?
House Committee on Revenue for May 14, 2009 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 82. Manson?
Mr. Chair, House Committee, good morning. Senate Bill 82.
Gentlemen, we're on the record. We're on the record.
Sorry.
Thank you. Manson, go ahead.
Senate Bill 82 comes to you after it went through the parallel committee in the Senate, the Senate Revenue Committee, and that it got amended a little bit before it came to you. In the beginning, it was both a requirement for housekeeping in the budget side, going from a biennial budget requirement to an annual budget requirement. And the section that got amended in the Senate side was the videolare segregation or separation of the costs in reports. That was taken out by the Senate Revenue Committee, and the bill comes to you today only as a budget report on an annual basis rather than biennial. And in that sense, Mr. Chair, the fiscal effect or fiscal impact is none on this bill, and as well as the revenue impact, nothing.
Thank you. Let's hear from the Lottery Commission. Larry, is it Nicewender?
Yes, it is.
Thank you. I'm normally not even close.
You did good. Chair Barnhart and committee members, for the record, my name is Larry Nicewender. I'm the deputy director at the Oregon Lottery, and I'm just here to provide a little bit of brief testimony. Mazen has very succinctly summarized the bill. It is, in fact, a bill that the Lottery Commission has worked very closely with Legislative Fiscal Office, Legislative Revenue Office, Governor's Office, and Budget Management to come up with some language that really updates the statutory requirement on the lottery. When the statute was originally set, I believe in 1985, when the lottery was formed, it contemplated a biennial budget report and a biennial budget review process. However, the Lottery Commission has an annual budget process and does want to provide this information on an annual basis to the legislature, the governor's office, and Legislative Fiscal Office. And so we worked with those individuals who are all named in the bill to come up with some language that would work for them. And we are actually asking to report annually versus biennially in an effort to make sure we give timely and accurate information to the legislature. And it coincides better with our budget process and our ability to report timely.
Thank you. Questions? This doesn't change any of our processes, does it?
Chair Barnhart, we
still will be writing a biennial budget.
Chair Barnhart, you doesn't affect the Ways and Means process in any way, shape, or form. It is simply a budget reporting requirement that
right.
The commission report to the legislature.
Maybe you could review, for those of us who don't remember, how the budget process actually works for the Lottery Commission.
Sure. Chair Barnhart and committee members, the Lottery Commission actually reviews and approves the lottery's budget on an annual basis. We bring before them a budget in June of each year for their approval, and it's an annual budget. They approve it, and we execute on it, and then each month the commission meets, we provide budget reports back to them on actual expenditures, planned expenditures, much the same way that agencies would to you if you requested it.
Thank you. And what review, if any, does the legislature have of your budget, other than information?
It's really through that process, through this submission of this report, and through being the lottery director comes in, speaks to the legislature every session, goes over the budget at a high level, answers any questions that are available, and provides documentation as requested by the Legislative Fiscal Office and any member.
And is a budget bill required?
Chair Barnhart, no, there is not a budget bill for the lottery.
Your agency is a autonomous, or at least semi-autonomous agency that establishes its own budget, and doesn't answer to the legislature for its budget?
It's correct that the budget is adopted by a five-member commission that is appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions that generates? Thank you very much.
You.
Is there anyone else who wants to be heard this morning on Senate Bill 82A? All right. Thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 82A and open a work session on Senate Bill 82. Colleagues, what's your pleasure on this bill? Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 82A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 82A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Is anybody concerned about this bill? Now's the time.
Mr. Chair,
yes?
If I could just make one comment.
Yes,
it's sort of about time.
I agree with you. I think it is.
I did not realize that this was in there, that we are doing budgeting a la 1985 for an agency that is now much bigger than was ever contemplated in 1985.
Is that the year we passed the set up the lottery?
I'm getting nods out there, but
right.
It's like, holy smokes.
Yeah, all right. Is there any objection to this motion? The motion sends the bill to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. I don't see any objections, so the motion is carried. The bill goes to the floor. Who would like to carry this bill, or can I put it on the consent calendar?
I'd be happy to carry it, Mr.
Berger.
Chair.
Representative Berger will carry the bill, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 82. The next one that we have this morning is... I've lost my agenda already. Let's not do that. 183. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 183.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Senate Bill 183 specifies timeline for filing an application for a reduction of the maximum assessed value, MAV, of a demolished or removed property. It clarifies that the special determination of the maximum assessed value subject to multiple adjustment comes only after the application of ORS 308-146-8A that specifies the determination of the maximum assessed value of a demolished or removed property. It also clarifies that the appeal of the maximum assessed value of a demolished or removed property will be made to the local board of property tax appeals. I think that's the essence of the bill. And
thank you. Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips, the Department of Revenue. And just to give you a little background on this bill, for many, many years, when property was damaged by an act of God or fire during a tax year, the law has provided that the owner not necessarily have to pay for the full taxes for the full year because the property maybe didn't exist. That's just kind of a fairness issue that's been in the statute for a long time. One thing that was not in the statute was if property was demolished intentionally by the owner or if it was removed. Pick up a building, move it away. Taxes remained through the year. And this wasn't as big of a problem until Measure 50 passed. And as you might remember, Measure 50 created situations where the maximum assessed value, which is sort of the artificial limit on the taxable sort of value, would grow by 3%. There wasn't really any provisions for maximum assessed value to ever reduce, always just increase. So it became an odd situation where property would be demolished by the owner, the maximum assessed value would be there, and then they would build a new building, and the maximum assessed value for the new building would be added to the existing maximum assessed value, and you'd essentially have potentially twice as much taxable value on that particular property. So it was kind of a unique situation. Measure 50 actually specifically provided for this fix for any property that's damaged by act of God or fire, but not for demolition or removal. So Senator Morris last session brought this bill forward, and it passed. There, we've identified during this last 2 years three administrative issues with that policy change. This bill addresses those three issues. One of them, the first one listed in my solutions, my testimony, was that what Measure 50 provided for were five exceptions to the maximum assessed value growth. One of them is if new construction, new improvements. Another is if you subdivide or partition. And so when more than one of those five exceptions occur in a year, the assessors need to know, which one do I calculate first? Which one do I calculate second? So that I can get the correct value on the property. And this adjustment to maximum assessed value in last session's Senate Bill 697 didn't put that MAV adjustment in the ordering. And so it needs to be in the ordering so the assessors can figure out, where does this fit sort of in the scheme of things? Which ones do I do first? So that's just sort of an administrative step to keep the calculation going equal across the state for everybody. The second issue had to do with adjustments. The fix was actually placed in the statute at a point in time where the assessor, after the roll is complete and the assessor is fixing it, that affected to whom the appeal was made, because it occurred after the roll was finalized. Most appeals go first to a local board of property tax appeals, and then if there's an appeal from that, it would go to the tax court. This particular change was placed after the tax roll is completed, and the timing created a problem with those kinds of appeals in that the taxpayer couldn't go to the local board first. They had to jump straight to the tax court. And so this bill fixes that by putting the actual amendment part earlier in the statute with similar type amendments, such as the changes made for damages due to act of God or fire. This one fits naturally in that same section. And so we're moving it from later in the statute in Chapter 311 back to Chapter 308, where those kinds of things occur. And finally, I think I did one and then I did three. Now I'm jumping to two. Forgive me. Actually, I talked about two and three at the same time. So we moved it to Chapter 308 and fixed the ordering, and we also addressed the appeal process. So that's what this bill does. And I can talk through how it does it in the bill if you'd like.
I think that would be an excellent idea, since none of us have studied this bill.
Okay.
And if the committee is willing, I'd like to move it today. So why don't you go ahead and go through it, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Section 1 is the statute that says what the maximum assessed value of property will be. So that's in 308.146. And it says the maximum assessed value be 103%, essentially it grows by 3%, except unless five situations occur on page 1, lines 15 through 19, that area. So that's sort of the context of this statute. And also in this same statute, in Section 1, is the part about, at the top of page 2, line 1, where if property is damaged by act of God or fire, in the year that it occurs, the maximum assessed value is reduced. So what I'm trying to say is this is the sort of the context in which this change was made. So instead of having this fix from last session be in Chapter 311, we put it at the bottom of page 2 in the same section where other changes to maximum assessed value are allowed in the year that they occur. So at the bottom of page 2, line 43, to receive the reduction in maximum assessed value, the property owner must file an application for the demolishment and removal of property. That's where this is placed. And then on the top of page 3, it carries forward with the same language in terms of making sure that the language that was in Chapter 311 from last session's bill is moved to this section. Actually, I think one of the reasons why they put it in Chapter 311 last session was because there's an application required with that particular change in 311. And so we carry that application forward back to this statute to say, well, that was the policy you decided last session, so we're going to have an application. The owner of the property removes their property or demolishes their property, then files an application with the assessor saying, please adjust my maximum assessed value. I just did this. And the assessor can say, oh, I see. And they go out, they send a person out, the building's gone, and then they make the change to the roll. The appeal process.
Okay, excuse me. Before we go on, and I apologize, I said we were going to ask questions later. Would you let us help us understand how on page 2, sub 8A, B, and C hook together. A says you do one thing, and then B says the subsection doesn't apply if, and then C requires an application.
Mr. Chair, are we on page 2?
Yes, page 2. Lines 34,
line 34.
Up to page 3, line 10. I think that's all part of the same subsection. And I think I'd like to make sure I understand the logic of it.
Okay. So subsection 8, notwithstanding subsection, when a building, so notwithstanding the part of the statute that says the maximum assessed value will be 103%, notwithstanding that,
right,
if property is demolished or removed and it's reflected in the reduction of real market value, in other words, in the year that the assessor reduces the market value of property for that removal, that's the year that the maximum assessed value can be reduced.
Okay.
Part of the reason for that was is if a building had been removed 2 years ago and the assessor was not aware of it, the taxpayer comes in, files the application, the assessor can then actually reduce the real market value prospectively. And whatever year that occurs, that's the year the maximum assessed value can be reduced. So it allows for them to reduce it even for some types of properties that have already been removed.
Now, you mean retrospectively, don't you? Looking backwards.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
When the occurrence happened in the past, but the correction is done in the present time.
So let me translate. I think what you just said was that the building was removed in 2005. The assessor becomes aware of it in 2008. He can go back to 2005 to reduce the maximum assessed value.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. No,
that's not what you meant. Okay.
No.
I'm glad I asked that.
Yes. It actually, the bill, the way it was written last session, said that in the year that the real market value is reduced to reflect the demolishment or removal, that's the year. So had the assessor been aware of it 2 years ago, reduced the real market value for the property, the bill didn't have a retroactive piece to it
right.
to fix that. But
right.
if the assessor becomes aware of it in today's time and this bill is in effect, then they can reduce the maximum assessed value.
As of the time they become aware of it.
Yes.
Thank you.
Carrying on with subsection 8. The section does not apply to property assessed under the statutes listed there. Those are the central assessment statutes, so it does not apply to large companies that are railroad, airlines, those kinds of things that have properties come and go all the time.
Because your assessment method is completely different.
Completely different,
okay.
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah.
The other exception is that if the demolishment or removal is so minor that it doesn't constitute what's termed in Measure 50 as minor construction, then no adjustment is made. And in Measure 50, sort of defined minor construction as anything that's under $10,000 in any particular year of value or $25,000 in any five-year period. So the whole idea with that particular part of the amendment was that the drafters didn't want assessors going out to properties and saying, oh, here's a brand new deck, let's add that and increase your taxable value. The deck was the example they used. If you were here, you probably remember that, or if you read the paper. But the deck was what they used, and they said, we don't want you making these adjustments for small changes. So to receive the reduction, and now it's line 43 on page 2, the property owner files this application after it occurs and before December 31st following the assessment date. If, okay, and this is where the timing is a little, I mean, we spent a lot of time with legislative counsel last summer trying to figure out this language, but in order to have an application and realizing these events can happen any time during the year, just before an assessment date, just after the assessment date, it gives them a chance to file and the timing works for the assessor to actually get it on the following tax roll. You want me to talk through that?
Well, I don't, but someone else might. I guess not. Go ahead.
Okay.
Then you define what a property owner is. I think we get that part.
Okay.
Right, then you were in the middle of the next explanation when I interrupted, so go ahead.
I think I've said everything I had in mind.
Thank you. Colleagues.
It's a complication.
Representative Berger.
This is supremely ironic that we are working with this section of statute since I just destroyed a building. And I purchased and destroyed a building, believe it or not, as described here. Fortunately, I don't have to declare a conflict because the building is not... I did it, but it's my children's name, and so I don't, there's no real conflict here because I don't own it. I just did it. It's complicated. but I guess, John, I wasn't aware of all these problems because I just called the Tillamook County Assessor and said, I'm going to destroy this building. What do I do? And they said, when it's down, send us a letter and we'll go out and look at it and we'll reassess you. And it worked perfectly. So I guess my question for you is, are all the assessors aware of how complicated you've made what seemed to me a pretty straightforward process when I did it last year? I know that's a backwards question, but it was so simple I couldn't believe it. I called them up and said, what do I do about taxes? I'm about to take a house off the tax rolls. And they said, send us a letter. And I sent them a letter, and then when my taxes came, it was reduced by the value of that house.
The name of that is application.
Yeah.
That letter.
Yeah, I guess so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger. Yes, the reduction in value should occur, and that shouldn't even take a letter other than they need to know so they can come out and look.
Yeah, and but I called them ahead of time because I thought of this ahead of time.
Very good. But you want to be sure that the maximum assessed value is ultimately reduced. So Tim Lutz there in Tillamook County will want to, the assessor will want to reduce the maximum assessed value too, so that not only is your market value reduced, but then your taxable value is reduced too.
Okay, I got to check on that.
The assessors... The assessors are operating under the existing law. This just refines the existing law a little bit. They were a little split on whether an application was important or necessary. The Senate, particularly last session, the discussion was, well, what if somebody is, trying to game the system or something, and or what if the assessor doesn't know about it? How will they know? And so they said, well, let's just have an application. And since the department doesn't typically promote policy changes, we just kept what was in the statute and moved it into this bill and tried to make it work. So we aren't necessarily wedded to the application. Many of the assessors weren't either. Some of them were. And they just wanted to know so that they could make the change. And in your case, you know, you call them up. Now,
and they asked actually for a, when it's down, they said, send us something that says it's down.
Mm-hmm.
Which I did. I don't even know what I said.
Would you intend to define this application in rules, or would you just leave it bare in the statute? The reason I ask the question is because an application can be, if it's not defined, could be that letter.
Mr. Chair, I don't think there are a lot of sideboards around it. It could be very, very, very minimal requirement.
Or it could be a form that the assessor fills out from the information given to the assessor on the phone.
Mr. Chair, exactly. Typically, what you're going to find is your assessor is going to be just so willing to work with you on it that it's not even going to become an issue, in my experience.
Yeah, now that I think about it, I think they sent me a form, and I just filled it out that basically was address. Some way they could identify the problem. I think it was that simple. I think the form was sent to me. I know that it was effortless, and they worked with me very well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, from an equity issue, most assessors were doing this anyway, to be honest. I mean, it was you remove a building, you've got a $100,000 taxable value, you build a new building, and you get now you have $200,000 taxable value, and you have basically the same building, just a little newer. So it, from an equity standpoint, it made, you know, perfect sense.
Okay. Anything else for Mr. Phillips? Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today? Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 183. Colleagues, do you want to work it today?
Sure.
All right. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 183. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 183 to the floor with a veto-pass recommendation.
Representative Bailey moves Senate Bill 183 to the floor with a veto-pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Is there any objection to it going to the floor with a due pass recommendation? Don't all speak at once. Good. With that, the motion carries.
I'd be happy to carry this.
Thank you.
Also had experience in this.
Well, Representative Berger, I had earlier thought we were going to spread these around, but I agree with you. I think that given that you've had
experience with
this particular topic, this would be a great bill for you to carry. And if there are any questions on it on the floor, you'll be the ones who can best answer them. So Representative Berger will carry the bill, and we'll close the public hearing on, the work session on Senate Bill 183.
Bizarre that that.
And what do we want to do next?
Do I take them in order?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, we'll have to take them in order. All right.
Yeah.
We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 180. And Chris is on that one.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
Now that I think about it, that property is in my name, so I do have a conflict of interest, maybe.
All right, well, we'll note your conflict, and you've explained it in great detail.
She has everything.
We've got it. We'll note it for the record.
Yeah.
Thank you. And
property next door is in my children.
We're in public hearing now on Senate Bill 180, so I hope you can untangle that. Why don't you come up? All right. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 180 is another Department of Revenue bill, and it would require an affiliated group that files a consolidated tax return to include REITs and RICs, real estate investment trusts, and regulated investment companies in that tax return. It would apply to January 1, 2010. And the context for this is that Oregon law requires corporations that file a federal consolidated tax return to do so for Oregon. However, at the federal level, these types of entities aren't required to be in part of that return. So the starting point, some of these entities can be excluded from the federal or from the state consolidated tax return. And so there's an incentive for corporations to set up entities that have no economic purpose. And so this would pull those in.
I see. All right. Please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue, and I've asked Katie Lawley with our corporation section to join me for technical questions. As Chris explained, the starting point in calculating Oregon corporations' taxable income is the consolidated federal tax return, and certain entities are not included in that return under federal law, and specifically what we're looking at in this bill are real estate investment trusts and regulated investment companies. Those are not included in the federal consolidated return, so they are not in the starting point for Oregon. And what we have found is that a corporation may set up a real estate investment trust or a regulated investment company, transfer assets to that separate entity in order to reduce the apportionment formula for Oregon taxable income, thereby reducing the Oregon tax. And when we have found these in audit, we have adjusted them and disallowed the transactions on if we determine that there was no valid business purpose for setting up that entity in the first place, that it was merely to reduce the Oregon tax liability. And what this bill does is require that, as a matter of practice, the corporations are required to include those real estate investment trusts or the regulated investment company in the return for Oregon, even though they are excluded from the federal return. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Irwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned REITs and regulated investment companies. You mean SEC regulated investment companies? And then I'm curious, are we just talking real estate investment companies other than REITs, or are we talking all asset classes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, the real estate investment trust is specifically defined in the federal code. So it is a trust that meets the requirements of the IRC.
Right.
The regulated investment companies, I believe, are just mutual funds. Typically, that's how they are classified. But those are also defined in the federal code.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you went over the apportionment issue pretty fast. Would you flesh that out a bit more so I make sure I understand it?
Mr. Chair, the Oregon law now requires that corporations generally, with some exceptions, use single sales factor apportionment.
Yep.
To apportion income to Oregon. So if you have a multi-state corporation doing business in several corporations, for Oregon purposes, they take that total business income, and then what comes in through to Oregon is the ratio of that income multiplied by Oregon sales, divided by total sales. And what we have seen is that corporations will move assets into these shell or types of entities in order to reduce the assets, and then also to create intercompany transactions that reduce the taxable income coming to Oregon.
Yeah, Representative O'Call.
Thank you, yeah. Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that I understand what's happening. So you have a company, and they have different entities underneath of it. And if one of these entities is a REIT or RIC, that's not included in the company's income for tax purposes. So they can funnel money to that company and avoid tax liability. Is that what's happening? I just want to make sure that I'm understanding correctly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, the way the federal law works, these companies are not included in the consolidated return for federal because they are required under federal law to pass all of their income out to the owners. So it's not taxed at the entity level. It's flowing out to the owners of the entity. Shareholders of a REIT are paying tax. Or if you think of mutual fund investments, you might have. All of that income is being reported to you, whether it's capital gains, interest income, dividend, et cetera. And because it's being reported to you as an owner of the mutual fund itself is not taxable. So for federal purposes, all of this is being taxed at the shareholder or the owner level. The entity is not taxed. However, when you come to Oregon, because they're not in that consolidated return and they're not in there for the starting point, even though the income is being passed out, but it may not be coming to Oregon taxpayers. So pulling it back into the consolidated corporate return means that it's going to be treated just as if it were a part of, it's going to be ignored, basically, for purposes of income distribution or allocation.
Ms. Chair, if I could have a follow-up. So current practice is to, if you're doing an audit and there's no what was the term, no business-related?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, the term I used was a valid business purpose.
And this bill, does it grab all of them, not just simply those that have no valid business purpose? I hope it grabs all of them and not just those that are current practice. I guess what I'm saying is what we're doing simply codifying into law the practice that the agency is using, or are we going a bit further and saying that this is going to be all of these entities are going to be included in the consolidation at the state level?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, page 2 of the bill, lines 6 through 8, that is the new language, and that is what is providing that any entity that's a real estate investment trust or regulated investment company is going to be included in the consolidated return.
Great.
Assuming they're part of the affiliated group.
Okay. Was there another hand down here?
Well,
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, I'm still trying to get my head around this concept, so please go ahead.
A little bit. I guess I can back into the – I mean, obviously, I would imagine that there are, for first of all, companies that are engaged in this practice now or – should I say this correctly – are not breaking law. I mean, they're completely within their rights in Oregon statute to do what they're doing now. That's correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, that's correct.
Okay. And so I'm looking at the revenue statement, and it talks about, you know, $600,000 this biennium or next biennium and on forward, million two. Trying to back into how many companies or how big a dollar, how many dollars we're talking about here. I mean, how big a problem is this? How many companies, how many firms? And I know it's an estimation, but I guess the question is, how did you get to this estimation working with Chris or whomever put this together to get an idea of how big a problem this is? And I ask that question in comparison or in contrast to the question or the thought we have to have, which is we're going to ask companies to spend more on accounting and administrative costs to do this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, the it's not a huge problem. We do see it. But in response to your last question, if the corporation is doing this merely to avoid Oregon tax and they're going to be required to include them in a consolidated return, they could potentially avoid those administrative and accounting costs by simply not doing it in the first place, because they have lost their, they have lost the incentive to do it. They're not able to shift the income by setting up the
If I may follow, so you, basically you're saying, I mean, and once again, this getting into the weeds of what it costs to do this sort of thing. Basically, you're saying it would be no more expensive. It's an accounting trick to do it the way it is, and it would be an accounting not trick, but an accounting path to do it the way it is, and a different accounting path to do it what's outlined in this bill. Not necessarily any sort of cost increase.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, they might actually see a cost decrease because they would not have to set up the entities in order to shift the tax out. They would simply not do that any longer.
Yeah, under the rule that taxes ought to have the least impact as possible on business operation, this actually improves that, doesn't it? Because then there would be no incentive to set up a corporation the sole purpose of which was to avoid paying taxes.
Mr. Chair.
I mean, the business entity situation would be cleaner under this bill than without it.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
In the overall system of business. There may be some business reasons why a corporation would set up one of these corporations and why a business group would do that. That would have a business reason, and this bill will have no effect on them doing that. They simply have to report the income as part of the Oregon Consolidated Return.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Bentz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The key phrase is the one on page 2, line 7, based solely on the application of. Is that correct? The idea is that if this is, if you had formed one of these entities, then you would be filing, maybe another way of putting this, you're not a member of the affiliated group because of the application of 1504. So you look at that, and I think the way I've thought this through is that if you will go directly to that line when you're talking to anybody that you want to have filed a consolidated return, and you would ask, is this the sole reason that you are not a member of the affiliated group? Hope I've asked that right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, yes, and the reference here is to the treatment of real estate investment trusts and regulated investment companies. So if that is the only reason, it is not in that federal consolidated return, because it is a REIT or it is a RIC. No other reason,
right.
Then it's included in the Oregon return.
Right, to follow up, Mr.
Yes, please.
So if there are additional reasons, then one could argue if you were the parent corp, we shouldn't have to file a consolidated return because, and they'd have to fill in a whole bunch of reasons. What would they be? I can't think of one offhand.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I think I might need some help on that one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, Katie Lawley with the Department of Revenue for the record. The biggest reason that I could think of is because the REIT or RIC that is set up is not part of the unitary group. Because of the federal constitution and the Commerce Clause, we have to, any corporations that are grouped together in our consolidated return have to be part of a unitary group. That is, they have to have certain interactions or certain connections. So if the entities are set up completely separately and there are business reasons to do that other than just tax reasons, then that would, I think, be a reason why they would not be included under this.
And thus would not have to file a consolidated return. That's what I'm getting at here is there still would be opportunities for folks, for entities to exist that would not have to file a consolidated return. They could escape from this paragraph is my question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, that's correct.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Bruin.
Mr. Chair, and this isn't a leading question, but are we convinced this is not a three-fifths vote?
That question also occurred to me. I don't think it is because it has to do with tax administration, but and apparently it either didn't come up or else he thought it wasn't because it doesn't indicate on the form that they thought it was.
I ask because it would be a change in statute that directed certain entities that are not paying taxes now to pay additional taxes. So,
well, I think the testimony that we've heard is that when they audit these these entities, and they discover that there is one of these subject entities that is subject to 1504B6, they ask for the tax to be, the return to be essentially redone, and that and the new information applied to the taxes. Maybe this is a question for Chris. Is this revenue impact because it is a change in the tax law, or is it a revenue impact because of more information contained in the return?
Mr. Chair,
or both?
It is the latter. It's on the Senate side, all of the discussion was around it being a tax compliance issue,
right?
Which is why the 3/5 didn't come up. The revenue estimate here, in talking with the Department of Revenue, is based on historical audit information and what they've collected via audits by correcting these returns. And the estimate there is a shot at the amount of revenue that is essentially missed by audits,
sure,
to companies that didn't get audited. So in that context, the revenue impact and everything is from a tax compliance standpoint.
Right. That was the issue that occurred to me as well. That's why I'm very glad you asked the question, because I think it's an important one. Other questions? I'm still trying to understand the basic concept, and I apologize for being a little bit slow this morning. If I were a company, or a group of companies, how would setting up one of these organizations help me in the process of avoiding paying Oregon taxes? I've got the formula. I understand the formula, but I don't, would these be investments in out of Oregon in other states, or would they be investments in Oregon? How would I go about arranging myself in such a way that I could reduce my Oregon taxes using this mechanism?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, generally the assets that they're putting into these entities are income producing. So we're talking about the income that is being generated from the assets. So it depends on where the assets are located. If it's a mortgage loan, where the property is located. If it's an intangible asset, where the intangible asset is being used. And so when that income comes into the real estate investment trust, it's not being represented in the apportionment factor of the consolidated group. And since we only have a sales factor now, that can greatly skew things. So they're just taking out, they're taking out all of the income. It can be Oregon income as well as other state income. So they will get some in the numerator, so to speak, of the apportionment, and in the denominator. But we're just looking for fair representation of that income.
Right. Well, one of the things that was said was that this income is attributable to the owners of the entity. If this corporate group is 100% owner of one of these entities, which I assume is the situation we're primarily talking about, wouldn't that income come into that into the consolidated return simply because under the federal rule the income is not taxed at the REIT or the RIC but in the other corporation? What have I missed here?
Mr. Chair, basically the income is there. The income is there in the consolidated return. The problem is the representation. For federal purposes, they just tax everything.
Right.
For Oregon purposes, we have to apportion to find out what is the Oregon portion, and we do that with the sales factor. If we don't include that income stream, the Oregon portion of that, then we're not representing the income from the unitary group that is coming from Oregon.
Okay, so the effect of one of these activities is to reduce the denominator, I'm sorry, increase the denominator while not increasing the numerator, Oregon sales, and therefore giving us a smaller fraction when we multiply that against total income.
Mr. Chair, actually, when are you talking about when they
miss when they do not account for these incomes in the consolidated return?
Mr. Chair, actually, they would decrease both the numerator and the denominator. So it would depend on the revenue increase or decrease, there could be both. It would depend on the ratio of the Oregon income over the everywhere income.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Other questions for this panel? Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard this morning on Senate Bill 180? I don't see anyone, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 180. Colleagues, are you ready on this one? All right. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 180. Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, I remove Senate Bill 180A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bailey moves Senate Bill 180A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Is there any objection to moving this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation? All right. The bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I nominate Representative Call.
Yeah, I'll carry this. I'll carry this bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Call will carry. Thank you.
Thank you. You didn't care for my note.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. That will close the work session on Senate Bill 180 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 181. And I think you can just stay here. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 81, another Department of Revenue bill. And the intent is to add clarity to existing statute pertaining to the removal of intercompany sales and expenses associated with the sales. And this all pertains to intangible property. And it essentially clarifies that expenses are added back to the return when the sales to a related member for the use of the intangible property have been excluded in the return. Generally, for intercompany sales, when the income is included and the expenses are included, it turns out to be a wash, so it doesn't matter. In some cases, though, the income is excluded, but the expenses are not excluded. So this would just make sure that the expenses are excluded, so that they're either both included or both excluded.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. As staff indicated, this is dealing with transactions between related corporations, and it essentially adopts a multi-state tax commission uniformity recommendation that provides when you have these transactions, they need to be added back on the corporate return. It also allows a credit if another state is actually taxing income paid to the corporation in that state. The credit would be allowed on the Oregon return. We do have an administrative rule under ORS 314.295, and I did provide you a copy of that statute on the back of this handout. The administrative rule requires an addition for these expenses in order to prevent evasion of tax, or if the deduction is not clearly reflective of the business activity conducted in Oregon. So we have the rule under that statute, but the Senate Bill 181 is making it more explicit in the statutes themselves when these transactions need to be added back on the Oregon return. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr.
Representative Burns.
There was one no vote on the Senate floor. Was there any articulation of what that no vote was related to?
Do we know, Chris?
I don't recall a specific reason for the no vote. I don't recall either on the floor or privately.
Okay.
A particular reason.
Okay.
That.
Thank you.
This is another bill that, indirectly at least, related to SB 180, in the sense that it deals with related corporations and ways of manipulating sales and purchases between them in order to avoid taxes with no other business, essentially business purpose. Is that a fair characterization of this bill?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The multi-state tax commission, if it's like the other multi-state groups, comes out with many different suggestions usually, at least that's been my experience. I'm just curious, this, have you in the past chosen to adopt the multi-state commission's recommendations most of the time, and have you found those recommendations to be generally correct? Just as a comment, I've always found them to be well thought out and generally right, but I'm just curious what your experience has been.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I think we would agree with that assessment. We do, in our rulemaking process, look at their uniform recommendations and adopt them to the extent we can. And if they do need to be adopted statutorily, we very often bring them to this body for consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Has this issue been addressed by that group? And if so, is this different from that?
Mr. Chair, this is actually based on a uniform recommendation of the MTC. The language has been modified a little bit by Legislative Council, as they typically do, but this is derived from their recommendation.
Thank you. Anything else? All right. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on Senate Bill 181? I don't see anyone, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 181. Any reason not to work this bill today? All right, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 181. Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 181 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bailey moves Senate Bill 181 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Is there any objection to the motion, that is, to send this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation? We're doing well today. Motion carries. Who would like to carry this bill? Representative Bentz will carry. Thank you. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 181. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 182. Chris?
Senate Bill 182 adopts a uniform definition of a financial institution. Currently in statute, there are two definitions. And I think you'll hear some detail on those in DOR's testimony. But this essentially adopts a uniform definition of financial institution.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. This Senate Bill 182 has two components in it dealing with the definition of financial institutions. First, it repeals an obsolete definition that was relevant when financial institutions were taxed at a different rate than other corporations. So that definition is no longer relevant and would be taken out. The other change is, again, to adopt a uniform definition proposed by the Multi-State Tax Commission. The effect of this, we believe, is to treat some types of entities as financial institutions that are not financial institutions under current law. And the primary example probably is with credit card companies that don't meet the current definition of financial institution, even though you might think of them as a financial institution in the way they do business. So what we're looking at here is really something of conformity of treatment. For example, a bank that issues credit cards is treated as a financial, and its credit card subsidiary is treated also as a financial for purposes of filing the return. A standalone credit card company, however, would not be considered a financial institution under the current definition in Oregon law and would be using non-financial apportionment rules to report its income. So this really takes into account what's happened at the federal level with deregulation and changes in the way businesses operate and what companies are allowed to do, and brings the Oregon law a little bit more in line with those activities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There seemed to be quite a bit of concern in the Senate about something. What was the issue?
Yep, I was going to ask that if you had. It looks like that there were 11 no votes, so that was a considerable opposition. Do we know?
To my understanding, and part of this was in the Revenue Committee as well. Perhaps the best way to describe it was a lack of understanding by all members of exactly what the impact of the bill was on the institutions involved. So I think that uncertainty, that level of uncertainty, is reflected in the votes.
Okay. Let me ask it a different way, unless you want to ask another question. Let me ask it a different way. If an organization is considered a financial institution, how is it taxed differently than if it's not considered a financial institution?
Mr. Chair, Oregon law provides that non-financial institutions use certain types of apportionment rules that are laid out in the statute. For financial institutions, ORS 314.280 provides that the department will adopt rules to prescribe apportionment. And there are differences in the way apportionment is calculated for financials versus non-financials. The one of the differences, since we have moved to single sales factor apportionment, is that cost of performance is used in the non-financial apportionment rules, which means a company can assign its costs to the state that has the majority of.
Just the Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Katie Lally with the Oregon Department of Revenue. Just the preponderance of the expenses.
The preponderance of the expenses. So the company can assign its income to the state that has the preponderance of expenses under the cost of performance rule. And the cost of performance rule, I believe, is not used in the financial organization apportionment.
It is, but to a lesser extent.
To a lesser extent.
Okay, so back up and say it one more time so I can get the whole thing down.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for non-financial organizations, they would use for their intangible income, income received from intangible assets or services, they would use cost of performance, which means all of the income is assigned to the state with the preponderance of the expenses or costs. For financial organizations, there are more specific rules. For instance, interest, because most of their income is going to be from services or from intangible assets. So we have more specific rules to explain how they should apportion the different types of expenses or income.
Would you describe what an intangible income item might be?
Mr. Chair.
For the purpose of this bill.
For example, a mortgage loan. Interest on the mortgage
okay.
loan.
So interest received. Okay. So all of a sudden this is clarifying, because banks make very nearly all of their money, or credit card companies make very nearly all of their money, either from fees or are interest earned. And therefore all of it would be classified as intangible, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chair, Most, if not all, of their income would be from intangible assets.
So let me see if I can paraphrase. It sounds like what you're saying is that we allow a fairly blunt rule, a fairly non-specific rule, to apply to organizations where most of their income is tangible. Income from operations, I make a widget, I sell it. The difference between my costs and what I get in is my income. Whereas we want a finer grained rule to apply to financial institutions, because otherwise, if you follow the preponderance of expenses rule, it may very well be that a business has very substantial operations in Oregon, but isn't responsible for taxes here at all, because the preponderance of their expenses occurs somewhere else. Is that a reasonable paraphrase of what we're talking about?
Yes, you have it exactly right. And if I could follow up for just a moment on your earlier question about
Please.
The Senate
yeah.
committee, I do remember now what some of the questions were in that committee, and one was whether this changes the taxability of corporations. And the response in that committee was that we did not believe that it does, that a corporation is either taxable or not taxable by Oregon. That's the first question. What this bill addresses is how the income is apportioned if they are taxable in the first place. And that's what it's dealing with, is the definition, because the apportionment rules depend on whether they're defined as financial or non-financial.
I see. And you think that we're adding credit card companies?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that this bill changes the taxability in the first place of a credit card company, but it does add them to the definition of
financial institutions,
and they would follow those apportionment.
Is there anything else that's added or removed from the definition of financial institutions that we know about?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's lines 17 through 19 on page 3 of the bill is a big question mark, and that's how our understanding, as my colleague says, it's a member institution, but how is a credit union not a financial institution?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, this is reflecting current law.
That's current law.
Under current law, credit unions are not taxed as financial institutions. And this makes no change to that policy.
Okay.
So, okay, getting back to the issue then of taxability, you're not changing who's taxable and who isn't.
Correct.
You're simply changing the way in which that person would calculate their apportionment if they have income in more than one state.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Call.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't mean to become really rudimentary here.
No, please.
I'd like to get
as rudimentary as we need to in order to understand the bill.
So I don't mean to belabor the point. So I'd like to start at the threshold question and then try to work our way through this. So let's say we have a credit card company in Delaware. What do they have to do to be a corporation that's taxable in Oregon? What do they have to do? They send a credit card into the state. Somebody in the state is that cardholder. Is that enough for them to have a tax liability?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, the statute requires that the corporation be doing business in Oregon, and there's almost a spectrum of activity that a company can engage in before it becomes subject to tax and is doing business in the state. Sending a single credit card into this state would not be enough to constitute doing business in Oregon. If a corporation is headquartered in Delaware, but it sends thousands of credit cards into the state for customers, and it markets in this state for customers, and it uses Oregon courts to take action against customers that don't pay, those types of activities would get that company to the point that it probably is doing business in Oregon and then would be taxable.
Okay, so now that we've, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind.
No, please go ahead. So, just to put a label on it, what you're asking about in that question is what's normally referred to as nexus, I think. Economic nexus for the purpose of determining whether a state's doing business in the state. Go ahead, ask your next question.
So that same credit card company, it's doing enough in the state. It has the nexus required to be doing business here. So we have that hypothetical entity doing that. Explain to me the difference between what currently happens with regards, and you don't have to go into great detail, but if you could show me, you know, the starkest contrast between what we're currently doing and what we would like to do under this bill and what that does for the state of Oregon with regards to revenue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hall, I'll take a stab and ask Katie to help me out.
Sure.
Assuming that the company is now doing business in Oregon, under current law, they would use the rules that apply to non-financial corporations to apportion income, which means they would look at sales, but they would also use cost of performance to determine where expenses should be attributed. And in doing that, they're able to look at where the preponderance of the expenses are incurred and assign all of the income to that state.
And so in this instance, Delaware being the home of the state, of the corporation, and them doing most all of their work from Delaware, they're going to be able to apportion the vast majority of what they're doing to the home state of incorporation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, that's an argument that the corporation could very likely make, or that there's some other state where they have most of their expenses incurred.
And under this bill, we would be changing that such that we're looking at what factors now again?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, under this bill, they would be using the rules that apply to financial organizations and cost of performance is used, but it is not as, you don't look at where the preponderance of the expenses are. So the expenses are spread to more closely match with the income generated.
Well, and Deborah, if I may, Representative Call, Mr. Chair, the credit card income is specifically apportioned based on where the credit card customer is located. So if they have, 10% of their credit card income from Oregon and 90% from somewhere else, then we would be taxing 10%.
I'm good on this bill.
So we essentially ignore the rule having to do with expenses for the purpose of the credit card company.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
So they could have all of their expenses in Delaware, but if their customers are scattered around the country and they had enough business in Oregon to be considered doing business in Oregon, then our tax based on their sales would be the proportional to the number of to the activity of the credit card holders in Oregon compared to the activity of the credit card customers everywhere. Is that a fair statement? Okay, thank you. I understand the point now. Thank you. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any justification at all that the banks could use that the old measure, the cost of performance measure, if I have this right, should still be applicable, that they should enjoy that price as opposed to that which I think would apply under this new statute? I mean, can they come in and say, we know it's an old rule, it's antiquated, but it still makes sense because...
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz. They could make the argument, but things have changed so much in the business, the way businesses are conducted now, that cost of performance is even starting to not make sense for non-financial companies. And the Multi-State Tax Commission is, I believe, looking at reviewing that apportionment rule to see whether it needs to be modified as well. So it... If anything, I think the states are looking at moving away from cost of performance as a good way to apportion income for even non-financials. That, as you may know, was adopted in 1959 when they brought the three-factor formula, I think I have this right, the three-factor formula for apportioning income, and cost of performance was seen as much less important at that time than what it has become today.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please, Representative.
It seems that again, that it takes us back to the Multi-State Tax Commission attempt to get all the rules the same, so there's not this incentive to game the differences. And so, this, if adopted, would bring us forward to match many other states. Is that a correct statement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I don't know that the exact. Definition would match exactly, but the types of organizations that would be affected would be similar to other states.
Yes, please. Yeah.
The financial organization, that is the label we place on those entities that would now have to comply with the new law, would be, I'm trying to get at whether that's going to be a more standard descriptive phrase so that we don't, again, have people trying to, or businesses trying to play one state off against the other. Is that correct? Are we moving toward a more consistent labeling of financial organizations if we adopt this, consistent with other states?
Yes, we are.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
So, if I understand, all this bill does is place people who do financial work like credit card companies into the definition of a financial institution.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question of Chris, I think, or staff. We haven't exactly got a room full of rapt audience here. When this
no bankers are here.
When this was heard in the Senate, was there testimony in opposition from financial institutions?
Representative Berger, there wasn't a lot of testimony from the financial sector.
There wasn't a lot of testimony on either side in support, I mean, the Department of Revenue, but other testimony in support of it or other testimony in opposition to it.
So it was a room like this.
Similar.
There were people who just find us fascinating for whatever reason. Okay. Deborah is going to weigh in here.
If I might, we did work with the Bankers Association in developing this legislation, and they were in the Senate Revenue Committee along with representative of the credit unions.
Okay, so they're well aware of this. Of this,
because it's not there.
Okay,
thank you.
They're fine. It doesn't change.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that if they had a problem, they would tell us.
They're the ones that are impacted.
That's right.
And this is their opportunity to come in and tell us.
Right.
I guess is my
point. And we did give the usual notice. We did. Okay. All right. Now, there's a piece of this bill that deals with double taxation, isn't there? You give a credit for taxes paid in other places on the same income.
Mr. Chair, I believe that's the other bill.
Oh, the other bill.
Dealing with the add-back
okay.
expenses.
Thank you. It is the other bill. Why is there not something like that in this bill? Is it simply not necessary?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe it is necessary because we're talking again about the apportionment. So assuming that all states have the same apportionment methodology that we do, there would not be the same income would not be in the
right.
apportionment factor here as it would be in another state.
Right. Now, we've been talking about corporations organized and doing most of their work in Delaware or North Dakota or someplace like that. But this would also apply to businesses doing most of their work, having most of their expenses in Oregon. It might actually reduce their apportionment, mightn't it, if they now came under the definition of financial institution and before they did not.
Mr. Chair, I think that is possible. It could go both ways.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Anything else? Anyone else want to be heard on this bill? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 182. Colleagues, where are we? Do we want to work this bill today? For any reason? All right. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 182. Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 182A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bailey moves Senate Bill 182A to the floor with a due pass. A discussion? Any objection? Motion carries. The bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there who would like to carry this bill? Representative Riley.
I'll carry.
Representative Riley will carry. Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 182. And I think it's true that we've exhausted our agenda today. Is that right? We have. Colleagues, tomorrow we hear from the state economist. There will be 16 people at the dais. Are we going to meet in this room? We're meeting here with the Senate committee. It's going to be at 8 o'clock. It'll be 8 a.m., the usual time. You will discover that you really enjoy sitting in the kind of chair I normally use because in order to get the extra chairs here, we're going to have to move the big ones. With that, yes, Representative?
Just a question. The last revenue report, the economist did a presentation in the House floor. We're not expecting that this time? Just do it all here?
Okay. Now, that was an interesting experiment, but we've decided to go back.
Is that a failed experiment?
I don't think so. The thing is, everyone is so busy now that I think the assumption is that other committees will be meeting and doing work, but the Senate committee is joining us.
Right.
So we're having a joint meeting. Is it a joint meeting? Or there are guests tomorrow? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say that yesterday you said today was going to be an exciting committee for the record.
Well, it was. We passed five bills.
This was
I think all of them unanimously. I consider that an extremely exciting day.
I do, too.
Thank you. With that, committee's... Oh, yes, thank you. One more announcement. Monday, there is no floor session. Expect to meet in this committee until noon. We're going to get a bunch of work done. Thank you. With that, committee's adjourned.
Recess or two,
yeah, we'll take recesses.